If you have the handout from today, it's on page 8 of 32. If you have the PDF file that was sent to you, it's on page 110.
Can you give us a moment to catch up with you? Well, it's also in the mail out, page 110.
Correct.
Go ahead, Mr. Stewart.
Okay. First, I'd just like to say that we sent the quarterly report out for September to the board members a couple weeks ago, and we're in the process of finalizing the December report at this time. What I'm planning on doing today is to cover the status of the recommendations first from both the FY06 reports and the FY07 reports, and then we'll go into more detail on several of the audit reports. And then we'll finish up with a discussion on what the current status is on the overtime. So starting with the next page, during this six-month period, we issued 115 contract audit reports and memoranda and 8 internal and investigative reports. On the contract audits, we had recommended savings on the various audits of approximately $9 million. To go into the status of the recommendations for FY06, as reported last committee meeting, we had 184 recommendations for improvements, and we've had 176 recommendations for the first 6 months of fiscal year 07 that were included in various internal audits. As of December 31st, 110 of last year's recommendations have been implemented, and 28 of the FY07 recommendations have been implemented. The status by report for the reports issued in FY06 are in reserve parking. The 10 recommendations still have not been implemented, and that's because the manager of parking resigned, and they've asked for a month extension until the end of January to be able to make the transition. And at the present time, they are doing the various functions to transfer the reserve parking function from Treasury to parking. On the bus security review, there's still 22 recommendations that have not been implemented. 5 of those pertaining to lighting, increased lighting at the bus divisions. Engineering is looking at the feasibility of being able to do that. 8 pertain to increased security by the police department, and that's a funding issue as to whether or not they can have enough funding and resources to be able to do the increased security. And 5 pertain to signage at the various bus garages that bus is in the process of looking to see what they can do to improve the signage. And there's 4 miscellaneous minor ones. On the overtime, there's still 20 recommendations to be implemented. I'll be discussing that in more detail later. However, on the 20 recommendations that haven't been implemented, 4 have to do with recruitment and vacancy issues. 14 into increased monitoring and oversight of the overtime, and 2 are union issues. The parking meter collection process, there are still 5 recommendations that need to be implemented. 1 is an issue on whether or not to replace the meters that we have, which are old and obsolete, with new meters. Of course, that's a financing and funding issue. 1 is on report and analysis of parking parking. There are 2 on policy issues that have to be resolved within the agency, and 1 is still, we have issues, even though notices have been sent out, there's still issues of employees parking in the parking lots not paying in the using those signs, etc. The restroom audit, there's still 2 recommendations that need to be implemented, and there has been progress though. One of them is on preparing larger and more visible signs at the kiosk. I'm told that the signs are to be signed and placed at the stations, and they anticipate having them there by the spring of this year. And the second issue is on considering a mechanism for the station manager to allow remote access to the restrooms, and operations has been working with engineering and safety to find a remote access. One has been identified and is being tested at one of the stations, and if it's approved by operations and the union and safety, operations will develop a cost proposal to determine what the cost would be to implement that in all restrooms, or at least in a lot of restrooms.
Mr. Stewart?
Yes.
Why would the union need to approve it?
Mr. Hughes? Left.
Okay. Go ahead, sir. He may have gone to use the restroom. Management didn't.
An offer.
There he is.
Trust us, Jim.
We want to know if the union gave you permission to leave the room.
We were talking about the issue on the remote access to the restrooms to be able to, and the question was asked as to why the union would need to approve.
What we're trying to work with is a safety issue, and we started with the technical side about where can the remote be done, and some of the restrooms are around corners, and we actually put them in. We went to three different locations to see where the station manager could access it with. We did bring our union representative and say, this is what we're going to do. They've asked us some questions from their perspective about what happens, what is their responsibility once the customer goes behind the closed door. Do they know when the customer leaves? Do they know when the customer not leaves? What are we doing to enforce the fact that the customer can only go through the bathroom? So the questions they asked us is not whether or not we have the authority to put in what we want. Their questions are, what are the responsibilities of the station manager once this customer goes out of the view? And what are we doing for the safety of the customer? So we owe them that answer. It's not necessarily an approval from the union, but we do have to address their concerns.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Stewart.
The transition to MV transportation paratransit, there's two recommendations still remaining to be implemented, and they're pertaining to monitoring and analysis. One is on MAX should periodically review and verify the subscription information on regular trips to ensure its accuracy, and the other is MAX should implement an IT data analysis function to monitor the use of the trapeze system and conduct internal oversight on the contract. And they have not been able to completely implement that yet, even though they agree with it and they're in the process, but they haven't implemented those recommendations fully yet.
Has a deadline been set to do it?
We've had a deadline prior. It was due by the end of the year. So right now, we would have to say that we will make sure that they do it by the end of January. Our auditor is continuing to do the monitoring from our standpoint to ensure that we have issues, but obviously we want to get out of that business.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that as part of our improvement of the JARC activities, funding activities in the last month or so, I think some of these activities are incorporated into those improvements. So I think that those are I think there's efforts under that program that will be consistent with the recommendations.
Okay. There's still one open recommendation on the Visa debit card security, and that is the debit credit switch, which is in testing right now, and they anticipate to have final testing of the equipment in the various stations by the end of this month. Health and Welfare Trust, there's still three recommendations open, and they're pertaining to development of procedures, and that's up to the fund administrator to do. Preferential treatment on the hiring process, we have four recommendations still open, two pertaining to training of the individuals and two pertaining to compliance, and they need to be implemented. Medical Service Branch, there was one recommendation, which is on procedures. And on the control self-assessment that we had done at Landover Garage, there's four that still need to be done. One is pertaining to security. Two are pertaining to bus training and upward mobility within the bus maintenance office, and one is a union issue. Last meeting, you had asked that we put the various recommendations that have not been implemented into various categories, and that's what I have done here. Implementation and process of the 52 of the 74, policies and procedures being developed of 5, budget and funding issues 13, labor union issues 3, and 1, no action yet. And the one that there's no action yet is on a cost analysis that was that we suggested in the bus security audit. It has not been done yet and may not ever be done.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Mack.
I just want to comment. This was my request, and I think it shows a tremendously different picture than a simple statement that says we have 74 recommendations that have not been implemented. So mm-hmm. It does show more motion. Actually, it shows just a little over 20 that are not in process. Even some of the others have action going on. So I think this is a good move.
Thank you, Ms. Beck. Stuart.
Okay. Going forward for the FY07 recommendations, and I will be discussing the issues in the reports subsequently, but there are 176 recommendations that have been made. 148 of those have not been implemented yet. Most of those issues are because the reports were just issued in late November and December, so there hasn't been time to implement the recommendations yet. But on unpaid traffic citations, there are 3 that still have not been implemented, even though they're almost finished. One is an analysis of the old citations that had not been analyzed, that were several years old, and they're in the process of finalizing that. One is on training, and one is an updating a policy, and the policy is going around through distribution right now. We did an updated review of the purchase card audit, purchase cards during fiscal year 06. We had 8 recommendations. One has not been implemented, and that's pertaining to new blanket purchase orders, and procurement is looking at the practicality of being able to do that. Payroll internal controls, we had 86 recommendations. 81 have not been implemented yet. They're in the process. The report was issued in late November. Of the 86 recommendations, 15 pertaining to the Office of Information Technology, 41 pertaining to the Office of Accounting, 17 pertaining to Human Resources, 11 to Operations, and 2 were union issues. Of those, Accounting has implemented 4 of the recommendations, and HR has implemented 1. And the next 3, nothing has been implemented yet because the reports have been issued in December. The 2 investigations that were done, tuition reimbursement, we had 6 recommendations. 1 has not been implemented pertaining to development of a procedure. And the car washes, which was employees doing car washes that were, and we'll get into that later if we need to, but employees using the car wash and not doing it exactly right. We had 18 recommendations. There's 10 that are still open, and they are enforcement procedures and improvement of the blanket purchase order procedures, and 1 is on training. And to give you a breakdown of those 148, 72 were in process, 15 where it's required of development of the policies and procedures, 9 there's no action yet, and 52 are the last 3 reports issued in December. The ones where there's no action yet are on the payroll audit, where accounting disagrees with 3 of our nine of our recommendations, which cover 3 areas, and we'll be getting together with them to discuss that to see how we can resolve that.
Mr. If you could just briefly remind us of the policy we put in place, I believe, 2 years ago, in terms of to ensure that your recommendations were taken seriously, the process, the negotiation, and the general manager stepping in.
Right. Yes, we issued our policy instruction 13.3, which requires, which is what we've been doing, is doing, actually it's a much bigger report than this, that covers each recommendation, and we follow up with each of the offices on a monthly basis to see what the current status is. We develop a timetable as to when they should be implemented, and we have a color coding process where that if it's green means it's implemented, yellow means that it's in the process of being implemented but has not been done yet, orange means that it hasn't been implemented yet and it rises to my concern, and red, which we haven't had to do since about the first year, was when it's just totally ignored and we have to take it up to the general manager for resolution. Okay, the next page just shows the reports that have been issued during fiscal year 07. Four that I plan on covering in more detail, unless any of you have any questions or want to cover any of the others, are the purchase card program, the payroll audit, the cell phone update, and the issues and concerns on the Austin railcar contracts. Now we switch to a Word document, which is right after what you have there.
You think we're that young, do you?
Yeah, is that her?
Yeah, well, I was going to start on page 19, unless they had any questions on the citation, report on the citations.
You can go ahead and talk to us.
Okay. Jim. On page 19, on the purchase card program, we performed a follow-up review. There we go. Follow-up review on our purchase card program. We looked at purchase cards or purchases from July 2005 to January 31st, 2006. And during that period, we had 187 cardholders spent $5.9 million. We reviewed these transactions to determine where there were issues. And we determined that 15 of the 16 recommendations from our prior audit report had been implemented. The remaining recommendation that had not been implemented, again, deals with blanket purchase orders, where procurement is evaluating the feasibility of being able to do what we recommended. There has been an improvement in the administration enforcement of the program in that we only had internal control issues with around $103,000 of the purchases, which represented 1.7%. Those internal control issues that we found were that some transactions did not have supporting documentation, meaning receipts, when it went through the process. That represented 101 transactions representing $53,000 worth of receipts that had not been obtained by the cardholder. We were able to determine from the vendor name, we couldn't see what was actually purchased, but from the vendor name that it did not appear to be anything that was out of the ordinary. It's just that the cardholder did not obtain any receipts, and it's an issue that we've raised several times, and it's being addressed by procurement, but obviously we don't have complete success yet. There were 16 split purchases, which means that the cardholder, there's a $2,500 limit, and in 16 cases, they purchased something that cost more than $2,500 by doing two purchases. They were, nothing was illegal or improper, but they were things that they purchased in that way. That represented about $21,000 worth of purchases. We had 34 transactions where the cardholders actually paid sales tax where we're not supposed to, represented $1,000, and they've been able to recoup $400 of that after we brought it to their attention. We made 8 recommendations for improvement. 7 of those have already been implemented. Most of those were dealing with the people that had, excuse me, had done the split purchases or had otherwise done something that wasn't in the best way, and that was some of them were their privileges were suspended, for some for 60 days, some forever. And there's one recommendation, as I said before, that has not been implemented yet, which is on the blanket purchase orders.
Okay. Any questions? Please proceed.
Okay. The payroll audit was issued in late November. We were part of our initiative to review financial internal controls, and it was also a request from the controller. We conducted a review of internal controls related to payroll. We had 31 separate issues that we raised in the report, and 8 of those are issued here, or listed here, I'm sorry. One is on the lack of documented policies and procedures for processing the payroll data in the old payroll system, which is still being used because we haven't fully implemented the new payroll systems. Also, going out in the field and talking with the superintendents and the supervisors and the timekeepers, several issues were raised by them on the payroll process, and as a result, we had 8 recommendations for the Office of Information Technology to make it better for them to be able to do their job. Field employees are not properly trained on the payroll system. There was a lack of communication between the field management personnel and payroll, the Office of Payroll people, regarding access rights to the payroll systems. Supervisory review in the field of the payroll data prior to the submission to payroll was not consistently performed among the various offices. Acting and temporary assignments, which are supposed to be limited to 6 months, were not terminating at the time. Policies and procedures pertaining to accounting and financial reporting were not current. And there's a lack of checks and balances within PeopleSoft, which is a new payroll system, when payroll checks are reissued. We made 86 recommendations, which I summarized by office previously. And the current status is that the various offices are working to have responded to the audit report, have given us what their opinions are, have given us what their status is, and 5 of the recommendations have been implemented, and most of the others are in the process. I mentioned that there's 9 that have not been implemented within accounting, which we will discuss with them because they disagree with the recommendation.
Any questions? Mr. Deegan?
Could somebody explain to me why we're still using the old payroll system after we spent all that money on the PeopleSoft system?
Mr. Burfield.
We still have...
Before you start, you know, I've heard from some of the employees here that we still are continuing having problems with getting employees' paychecks on time and the right amounts and stuff like that. And believe me, I can tell you from past experience, there's nothing else you want to do but get their paychecks correct here. Because all it's going to do is cause a whole bunch of consternation amongst the whole authority that's not.
I couldn't agree with you more. Let me deal with the first question first, and then I'll deal with that. The DTG stands for Details to Gross, and ETS are 2 old legacy payroll systems. This is why we're installing Kronos to replace those 2 systems. The Kronos contract will be issued by the end of this month. Again, I'm going to take ETS first and then DTG. And now we will have a completely modernized enterprise payroll system, essentially. This will replace, by the way, ETS plays all the salaried employees. I believe that's about 2,300. ETG, about 4,000. Unionized employees. So this will be a new payroll system, a feeder into PeopleSoft, which is the system of record of about 6,700 employees, or 6,500. This is just the continuing effort to get rid of our old legacies.
The question is
when?
Yeah.
The schedule says it's going to take.
I'm sitting here assuming that it had already been done since we approved that stuff.
We replaced Genesis, which was the old system we used with PeopleSoft. And Trapeze pays the bus operators, train operators, people like that. The second phase of this is replacing ETS and DTG, which are the other 2 legacy. We bought Kronos to do that. We expect that this will be a phased effort, a phased install. It'll take probably about 20 months.
How long?
20 months before it's completely done.
Ouch. Okay. Anything else, Mr. Dean?
No, good.
Okay. Well, complaints, the second question, Mr. Dean.
Oh, the complaints are less on the accuracy of payroll checks, they have gone down a lot. We have improved a lot and made that stuff. But most of the complaints now have to do with getting the paychecks where the employees are. We still have employees that are working in location A, and their checks go to location B. And then the other thing is, since we went to requiring direct deposit or debit cards, and right now we have everybody in the company either on direct deposit or debit card except for 700. So we're almost at 100%. But you still have what we call the advice checks. In other words, I have direct deposit, it goes into my bank account. I get a separate paper thing that says, this is how much I got paid, here are my deductions, all that kind of stuff.
And are you telling me we actually hand deliver those?
You still do. We are going to be bringing up what we call desktop management. This is another PeopleSoft function, which will allow electronic access to those things. That's probably about 6 months. And we should be able to get ourselves out of this. People will be able to go on electronically and take a look, and they can print it if they wish.
Have we thought of mailing the pay advices?
I believe actually there was a suggestion that we mail, but I don't recall why that was the case. Right. That really is where we want to get to.
So in 7 months.
Expect.
But I'd ask the question. I mean, with so many from the operating departments, with so many people, operators, mechanics who do not have access, I mean, how are we going to transmit that type of information to operating personnel? It's easy for people in this building or other buildings.
We already have installed, I believe, at 16 locations, field locations. We have touch screen monitors that people can get in. What we will have to do, though, Jack is exactly correct, is you can either do it from your home computer, and we can make that available, or everybody get their own password and will be able to enter any of the touchscreen systems. And we'll make those available in field locations everywhere. There's already 16 up. I think ultimately there's going to be about 35.
And I assume each of these locations will have printers attached to them?
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder what they're going to do.
The other thing I should also point out is as the board knows, we have a lot of movement of people out in the field, and this is how come we want to get to the electronic. It's very difficult for us to keep up with the movement because it's just a constant churn that goes on. The electronic really is the solution to this, where they can get to it anywhere. They can be anywhere and they can see it.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Stewart?
Okay. The next one I wanted to talk about was the update on the cell phones, which is on page 23 or on page 125, as the case may be. We reviewed the usage pertaining to the cell phones that were in use during the 2005 evaluation period. As a result of our audit, and as of February 2006, we had ascertained that instead of the 183 cell phone reduction that we had recommended in the prior audit report, there was 330 cell phone increase. We did, however, have some good news. As a result of our prior audit and actions by the Office of Administrative Programs and Services, cell phone users and departments are now on cost-effective phone plans where there's very few usage charges for people going over the minutes. We're all on shared minutes within the offices or departments. There was minor abuse of company cell phones by employees, and that four employees had calls that resulted in additional charges, which is a tremendous increase from the last time that we looked at it. The Office of Administrative Programs has prepared a budget to allocate the cell phone usage to each office and department during fiscal year 07 based on the 07 budget. Bad news is that we had $320,000 budget for cell phones in FY 07, and the anticipated cost will be around $800,000 or so based on the unit cost of $43 per user. And it's which would is I'm sorry.
Ms. Mack,
okay. I was just gonna comment. In my company we have a policy that the employee signs that if they go over their plan they have to reimburse from their own personal funds.
Right. We have a policy that they're supposed to pay for increased usage or personal usage. The policy itself needs to be improved so that we can have better enforcement. But each of the managers that approve the cell phone usage are supposed to check to see whether or not there is any personal usage or additional usage and obtain funds from the employee that's supposed to be sent to Treasury for those overages.
But it's the responsibility of the manager to keep track of that. There's no central way to keep track of it and just send a notice to the...
Mr. Boykin, you want to comment on...
Actually, the PI does make the employee responsible for all of them. Give their bill each month. They get their bill there to have it along the office record. If it's summer, it's supposed to be so both individuals are collecting the funds.
Excuse me, what's the PI? Is there any enforcement on this?
The only enforcement comes from Mr. Boykin's office right now to over and above what the directors who review the cell phones. One of our recommendations is to have increased accountability for cell phone usage both by the employee and by their approving official because of the issues that we have on either personal usage or no usage of a cell phone or, you know, high usage.
Mrs. Mack, I think by reallocating the expense back to the departments, I think that, you know, certainly has raised the visibility of cell phone usage and review of phone records. Obviously, we've got to continue to stay on top of this, but I believe all departments are certainly taking a more enhanced look at cell phone usage and the billing process and trying to constrain cost and reduce the number of units if at all possible.
Well, let me just comment. When I first saw this, I thought cell phone usage was $320,000, but you're saying it was budgeted at $320,000. And if we have never come close to the budgeted amount, I wonder how it got budgeted so low. Somebody must think that some action is needed here. And if we need to spend anywhere near the numbers that we are spending, since we were out of budget, there's a disconnect. And I think
right. There has been a disconnect. The FY 08 budget submission has $1.1 million in there for cell phones.
But the
prior years.
But the other point that I would make is that it is an improvement to send the charges back to the departments, but I think it's if you really are going to get to enforcement, you have to have individual responsibility. I don't think you're going to, if I use more than my allotted cell phone and my department pays, that's okay with me, as long as I don't have to pay. So I think we ought to look at that a little bit more closely.
Okay, Mr. Solomon.
Chuck was first, and I don't have to jump.
I was just being nice to you.
But he raised his hands first.
Mr. Diggin.
Mr. Boynton, you said that the employee is responsible for, you know, checking their cell phone bill, and that their supervisor gets a summary. Is that right?
Yeah.
Under our current procedures?
Yes. Each month, my office sends back the bills to the office directors, and the individual actually is handed their actual individual bill detailing all of the calls. The office director gets a summary which sort of outlines who may be excessive.
The summary doesn't include individual calls, though, right?
Correct. The summary...
He says no.
There are two things that go back. The office director gets the package, which has a summary on top, and he or she gets the entire package that they can scrutinize prior to individually handing it to each employee. So the office director does get the entire package. It's designed for him or her to review the package, keep the summary. If they have any questions, of course, they would address it. Then they forward it on to the employee. Then has a responsibility to review it as well.
Mr. Stewart, I'm not jumping ahead, but I understand you have further recommendations on the procedures on cell phone use.
Yes.
Okay. Well, before you get there, could I comment? I think one of the recommendations that I would make it to the general manager, I think before this comes to the board, we really ought to have a plan that gets us to a reduction of 183 instead of an increase of 330. And from what I hear, based on the budget, we've got an increase of $750,000 in the budget. I just think that's unacceptable. So we really need to look at how to bring this up to the budget.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Sullivan?
And Ms. Mack and Mr. Deegan already talked about some of the things, but Mr. Stewart, you talked about some improvements to the policy. I certainly want to see what you're suggesting and recommending to get the policy tightened so that we can make certain that the employee who has gone over is ultimately responsible, certainly when it comes to personal calls. Then in the first bullet, you're saying that the goal was to decrease the cell phones by 183, but there was actually an increase by 330. And the goal was to decrease it by such a large amount, but you increased it by an amount larger than that. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, our recommendations from our last report were to decrease because of the fact of low usage by certain employees. And that didn't happen when we went back to do our follow-up. One of the reasons is because there were an increase of employees within escalator and elevator section where they had about 70 or so increased phones. It was just a general increase across the board where even though Mr. Boykin's office is looking at it, directors and whoever put in requests for increased cell phones. My personal view is different than that, but that's what has been happening within the various offices that have been increased cell phones. And one of our recommendations, obviously, is that it needs to be looked at a lot closer than what it is now to monitor the use of cell phones and to see that we don't have unnecessary increases in cell phones that aren't being used as much as they should be.
Yeah, it needs to be addressed and tightened up at some point. And my last comment is we went over budget by $545,000. Where did we find the money to pay for that over budget item?
Right now,
if I could address the financial issue. This has some history to it. As I understand it, part of the issue was when PAC 2 was brought forth, a lot of people were given cell phones so they could be reached, company cell phones. And in my look at this...
What's PAC 2?
Oh, that's...
The passenger communications team.
Yeah, thank you.
Managers,
but
we have a problem in
so a lot of people, a lot of employees have cell phones for that reason and others. The biggest thing I see is there are a lot of phones out there with very, very limited use. A couple of calls a month, but we're paying, I don't know, Greg, $50 a month for these.
$43.
So one potential option, and from a financial standpoint and from a technical standpoint in Greg's office, we need to look at options such as maybe if somebody's on call, they don't need a company phone, but we could pay them a minor stipend for the use of their own phone or some mechanism like that. And what happened with the budget is these cell phones just grew very, very quickly, and there was no budget adjustment. So Greg's idea, and I think it's a good one, was to push the charges out to the individual offices, and the direction was you've got to absorb this cost increase within your office or you've got to trim the number of phones. I don't think the trimming is happening. So to summarize, we did increase the 08 budget, but I think we need to go back and look at some other mechanism, such as the stipend, and pull back a lot of these phones. There are too many phones out there without much use. I do not see abuse. I see just none, really, where people are abusing the cell phone. I don't think that's our big driver here.
I guess my concern is $500,000 in a $1 billion budget may not seem like a lot, but we still have to close this $500,000 budget overage, and I still haven't, I mean, you say you're going to send it back to the departments and ask them to work it in within their particular budgets, but I guess we haven't seen that come in our line item budget yet, how that's going to be addressed.
Well, and as I say, apparently the phones were issued without a budget adjustment, so we sort of got caught there. And the goal is that each office director is to manage that account. Now, whether they'll totally do it, probably not. The longer-term solution is really to look at the number of phones out there.
Thank you.
I think Mr. Woodruff has captured our concerns. And going back to Ms. Mack's item, between now and when this comes before the board, that delta, what for additional phones, if there's been a change in circumstance since Mr. Stewart did his audit, you know, this idea of the teams being dispatched, that's one thing. If it's just folks getting cell phones because they asked for them, that's another. I think you hear the sense of the board that we're not just ready to eat $500,000. That's something that if there's pain to be felt, it'll be felt at the level where the cell phones have been issued. That we're not inclined to absorb it. So if we could just, again, between now and the board meeting, come back with some answers on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd suggest that at least in the FY08 budget process that we make some adjustments in the budget amount and the number of phones that are in service, and certainly believe that we can get things better under control during that process.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Next report is on page 25 or 127. We have started a review of high-risk contracts, and the first report to be issued is pertaining to the Austin railcar contracts. It was recently released, so there's recommendations haven't been implemented yet, but the objectives were to ascertain the contract issues and concerns that have arisen, to evaluate what happened, why it happened, what the current status of the contracts are, and what can be learned from these issues and concerns to make recommendations for improvements in the current contracts and in future procurements of rail cars. A review of the issues and concerns on the Alstom contracts resulted in 48 issues that we have concern with, which we have summarized in our report. 8 of the major concerns are listed here. First is that the 2000-3000 rail car rehabilitation contract production schedule, which was originally anticipated acceptance of the final car in November 2005. The current schedule estimates that final car acceptance is going to be in December 2007, which is 2 years behind schedule, and it's a result of production being halted on several occasions over the course of the program. The 6000 series new car procurement schedule was estimated a completion of May 2006 for the base order of 62 cars, and the expected completion date of the option cars was September 2007. The scheduled completion date for the project remains September 2007, however, that's not going to happen. The schedule is being reevaluated, and the current projection by the program office for the overall project to be completed 3 to 4 months after that. The contractors, subcontractors, and WMATA personnel do not appear to be working as a team, which has caused issues and problems. There's a lack of coordination within WMATA. Identification of a problem with a rail car concerning quality or technical issues creates a lengthy process for resolution, resulting in delays to the production schedule. There have been several design and engineering issues with the 2000-3000 rehabilitation contract, including the remanufacture of the trucks, which is where the wheels are. air compressors, doors, automatic train control, propulsion and traction motors. Modest staff and Austin representatives confirmed that there have been significant issues regarding parts availability from the contractor for warranty and repair work at WMATA. Issues to date with the 6000 series rail cars include the center pin, the design of the heating and ventilation system, car leveling valve, and on-site warranty issues. And repair parts are not on-site at WMATA, and cars are not being accepted or progressing through testing as a result of the shortage, and this is a contractor issue. We made 42 recommendations for improvements for the current contracts and for future procurements. We issued the report in late December. The various offices are reviewing the report, and the program office has provided a preliminary plan for action on each recommendation included in our report and has begun working towards implementation of the recommendations for these contracts and for future procurements.
Mr. Stewart, your recommendation, you're highlighting an issue of concern. The next to last bullet on page 127, the contractors, subcontractors in WMATA do not appear to be working as a team. There's lack of coordination within WMATA. Perhaps whether it's you or Mr. Requa to comment on where are we with responding to the issue you've raised?
Mr. Chairman, I let Mr. File to come in and speak to this. Organizationally, we've made some changes within the organization as a result of the contracts with Alstom and trying to improve the reliability and the delivery of the 2,000, 3,000, and the 6,000. All of the engineering groups that are responsible for rail car procurement are now in the Department of Rail, not separated between the Department of Engineering and Rail. There's progress being made. There's no questions that there's delays. I know there's been more attention and more meetings between Alstom and getting stricter compliance with our people to do what needs to be done and trying to force Alstom to do as they need to be done in the most efficient manner. Jeff or Dan, comments?
Dan Hanlon, Chief Engineer, and Jeff Pringle, Senior Program Manager. As we've reported, Mr. Chairman, these are challenging contracts. We are working closely with Mr. Stewart on all of his recommendations. We have, I think, a very clear plan to implement them. Many of them have already been implemented, and the others are in active working.
Dan, can you speak to the working relationship between the parties, the changes to that in the last few months?
Right. As Mr. Requa mentioned, we have been shifted under the Chief Operating Officer for Rail. We are consolidating our entire commissioning process in the Department of Rail. We have a very focused effort in that regard. I think Steve is very committed to making this happen in a much more aggressive manner. We are working very closely with other authorities throughout the Northeast, including Toronto and New York, looking at their processes on how they receive their rail cars. We meet with that group at least once a month to talk about these issues, and by the way, they all have similar problems to us. So there's a lot of work going on, not only in WMATA, but in the industry at large. I think that certainly with regard to the 7K procurement, we will be revamping completely our acceptance and commissioning process for the new rail cars in the 7000 series. But these contracts that we're dealing with now are 7 and 5 years old, respectively. And we're working very diligently to close the gap on the issues that Mr. Stewart identified in his audit report.
Questions, Mr. Sullivan?
Yeah, I think Mr. Kaufman is right. Maybe it's the wording, and maybe it's my interpretation of the wording, but, you know, when I read the contractor, the subcontractor, and WMATA person, they're not working as a team. That raised concerns for us as a board, and to the extent that we can do something collectively on this side of the table to make it more of a team effort, we certainly want to know what those recommendations are so that we can maybe help facilitate you know, because the rail department's getting a lot of attention lately. I don't have to go through all the details that's occurred in the last 6 months, but rail is a very important component of this entire operation. So we need rail and the contractors and the subcontractors to work as a team as much as possible.
Yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. And our goal as a team is to do one thing very well, and that's to put reliable and safe rail cars into service for this authority. I think everybody on the team agrees with that goal. I think going forward, Steve's direction, Mr. Files' direction, we are developing a complete comprehensive commissioning program that I believe will resolve a lot of these issues that have been raised in Mr. Stewart's report. That's an ongoing effort that's basically involving all of the parties, all the stakeholders involved with this contract, both inside WMATA and outside WMATA.
Okay, but if we need to adjust some policies to facilitate the team effort, you know, we just want to get those recommendations at some point so that we can do whatever we need to do to make the entire authority work more efficient.
We'd be happy to bring those too. I mean, again, these are, as Mr. Hanlon mentioned, these have been long years of work. We've got commitments to the public to bring reliable cars, rehabilitated cars, and new cars into the system. We know we're behind schedule, want it on schedule, but we want the car to operate when it gets here. And, you know, that's the challenge in dealing with the U.S. manufacturer as well as the foreign manufacturer and bringing all that together. So it's a, you know, it's a complicated process. It's a very expensive process. And if there's something that we can ask the board for support, we'd be happy to come back to you.
Thank you. I would like to try and delineate the two pieces. You talked about the cars, the problem with the cars and how much difficulty you're having. And then you talked about the commissioning process of going out to get the cars and then the working relationship getting through the process. Help us understand the where the larger problem lies, not that either would be insignificant, but to what extent does the problem of the cars, as they come from the manufacturer, lie with the process that you're doing? Or is the process a separate issue? Because I think the point that Mr. Solomon has made about what we, the board, and the community must understand is if we can, we can put processes in place. Those processes can help us make the right choices in terms of working with the manufacturer and the like. But what can distinguish the two?
The issue of procuring rail cars, unlike buses, for example, it is a challenging one. We're dealing with a world car. This car, for example, the 6K that is now coming to us, has components and systems from 13 or 14 different countries. So integration becomes a very challenging activity. There are no, even though the cars are assembled in America, many of the parts obviously come from all over the world. So it's a challenging activity, not only for WMATA, but for every authority around the country. Processes that you identify to do validation of design, to make sure that the cars run well when they get here, were developed for these contracts 5-7 years ago. Now, one of the reasons I was hired here is to bring a new view of how to receive assets, including rail cars and other assets, to the authority through a comprehensive commissioning program. We're in the process of implementing that, and certainly that'll be a major thrust of the 7K program. We're trying to take some of those processes that you reference and bring them into the existing contracts that we have. Now, that said, there are primary and special provisions of the contract that we have to deal with Alstom as the manufacturer to make those changes. That's an ongoing discussion. Jack mentioned the partnering that we have with the manufacturer. These are ongoing activities. We have changes that we need to make, whether they're internal changes with the project management team or external changes with the manufacturer. We do that in a prompt and efficient manner, I believe. Issues are being resolved, and I believe, in a very professional manner. Yes, we're behind schedule, no question about that. And we've lumped in this particular report the 2K, 3K, which is a rehab project, with the new car, which is the 6K. And they're actually apples and oranges. Rehabbing a car is a very different activity than building a new car. much like renovating your house. You open up your house, you don't necessarily know how many pipes are bad, right? Same is true of a rehab car, rehabbing a car. Not to say that we don't have a good specification and a good process in place. Can it be improved for the next rehab program, which is the 4Ks, which will come up in 09 and 010? Absolutely. And we're getting all of the lessons learned and incorporating them into the program. One of the reasons the 6K program is as good as it is, I believe, Jeff picked up all of the lessons learned from the 2K, embedded them in the contract for the 6K. 7K is picking up almost 80 lessons learned from the 7K is picking up about 80 lessons learned from the 6K procurement and incorporating it in that. Internally, there has to be a understanding and a collective understanding that we need to work together to reach that goal. I think through the recent reorganization that Jack mentioned.
Okay, Mr. Yule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this has been very, very good dialogue, but am I the only one that just learning that this series 2003-3000 series is 24 months behind schedule, or is it information that we've all known in bits and pieces through budget meetings and operation committee meetings and this meeting and that meeting, or is because I think the problem, and again, my colleagues are right in terms of, you know, trying to for us to try to understand and how we the board can be of help, but I'm somewhat torn that we're just finding this out. And then in terms of how we can be of help, I appreciate what you're saying you're doing, but to me that's not good enough because I think this needs to be elevated to the level that we have a full discussion, a separate discussion in one of our subcommittees or as a board as a whole. And this is of high priority in addition to everything else that's of high priority, that we actually spend time in just talking about this. We have to get this back on track because it has a reciprocal domino effect. And if we can't solve the 2000, 3000, you get to, everything else is going to fall behind. And I just think that this is not something that we just gloss over and just simply say, okay, well, yeah, we're working on it. No, we the board need to hear what staff is doing and then offer how we can help facilitate some new recommendations, policies, procedures, so that we can avoid this from happening again. I mean, this is, again, I don't even know what the dollar magnitude of this is, but to me, it borders on, I don't even want to use the adjectives. It's sad to hear this. It really is.
Okay. Is deferring to Ms. Mack and Mr. Deegan, as far as this coming back to be focused on in more detail, one of our committees, I would imagine that'd be in our operations committee. So I guess next month or later this month, Mr. Deegan, perhaps if you could make note of that and bring it back. Okay.
I agree with you, Mayor.
Okay, I don't think we have any disagreement here.
I guess I didn't hear a response, although there may not be a response.
No, there is. I'll respond.
Expression on the faces.
I believe in our. Thank you.
That was a response.
We're sitting here with the gun.
I see the gun. The my recall is our operations committee agenda had a briefing on rail performance and on bus performance that since we didn't have the meeting, we didn't bring that forward. There are some financial issues that relate to this. This is coming forward to the budget committee and Chuck in February. We're coming to the board with financial issues that relate to these contracts. And I'd suggest that we also bring to the operations committee the operational issues with these contracts. Just in perspective, I mean, this is a huge contract, $300 and some million, and there are some impacts on this. I just mentioned as in the last year on the bus side, we had three bus procurements. We had three different fleets came in. We had issues with every fleet. One of the fleets we had 56, I think, issues that fleet defects, things that needed to be worked out with the manufacturer. They were resolved, and as with the press release that was issued this week, I think we've seen a 30-some% improvement in mean distance between failures. There's a lot of work, and I would agree that buses are simpler. They're manufactured generally in Canada, the United States. The parts are primarily from North America, and it's much simpler than a rail car. But there's an awful lot of work that has to take place to bring that around. And in the long term, buses have been delayed. Almost every delivery was delayed at some point in time because we wanted to get them right. They're on the street and they're performing. And I think Dan and Mr. Fuel and his group are all working to try to do the same thing, but it is more complex, and we'll come back with you with an operational report on the fleet and also the financial aspects of that as part of our capital review in February.
I think, again, to keep it in context, we realize that this is an industry-wide phenomenon since these are basically custom cars. And we realize that we have brought in the face of previous concerns, this extra added level of review. But showcase how this is taking place. It has to be very solid, understandable, that we can communicate to our riders and others, particularly since we are on the cusp of once again going after the additional capital dollars to expedite the rail program. We need to prove beyond a doubt that we are good at husbanding the dollars we have now so that we can make the case for those additional dollars. This is coming at a very critical time, so that presentation you make to us about how we are not only dealing with industry-wide problems, but we're doing better than the industry-wide norm in bringing this into control. We have to be able to make that case, make it strongly, or we will have a difficult time on the field.
If I may, I'd say I will. I will make sure that each member of the board gets a copy of the full report prior to that meeting and prior to our quarterly report coming out, so that you can see what the issues are and what the recommendations are to help you in your deliberations.
Thank you. Any other questions on the side? Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Okay. There were two investigation reports. Unless you have questions, I wasn't planning on going into any detail on them.
I think you can go ahead and jump to the overtime issue.
Excuse me, Jack. Okay. Last year, in February 2006, we issued our report on overtime. At our last audit committee meeting, Mr. Deegan requested that we do an update and do a follow-up audit, which we are in the process of doing the follow-up audit, but I thought that it would be appropriate to provide an update at this time. We had 23 audit recommendations in that report. Rail and bus and the police department have implemented some procedures to monitor and reduce overtime. Rail, bus, and operations planning and administrative support have provided updates to the status of the recommendations. The most thorough updates were from rail. And just to summarize, three of our recommendations have been implemented to date. The first one, the recommendation was that a copy of the monthly vacancy reports prepared by each office and operation should be submitted each month to operations planning. The status is the four bullets there at the weekly Chief Operating Officer Rail report meeting with his direct reports. The representative of operations planning is in attendance who reviews their vacancy reports. The rail directors report on the respective vacancies which are provided for operations planning for their reconciliation. Starting in January, which is this month, Human Resources has been invited to the weekly staff meetings to become more aware of the vacancy issues and produce more timely resolution. And the operations planning vacancy reports are updated nightly with downloads from PeopleSoft, and these reports are available online for offices and operations to use. The second recommendation that has been implemented is the recommendation itself, where superintendents, directors, managers, and supervisors in operations should focus more of their managerial attention on the issue of the increasing assignment of overtime hours and the effect that overtime hours have on the budget. The five bullets, next bullets, cover what the current status is. Rail staff meetings have devoted much time and discussion on the issue of the increasing assignment of overtime hours and the effect that overtime hours have on WMATA's budget. Reporting on overtime is now required of all rail management with justification for proposed overtime hours. The report is reviewed and approved by the Chief Operating Officer of Rail on a biweekly basis, And according to Rail, this new procedure has yielded reductions in overtime costs due to more intense monitoring and awareness of overtime costs impacts. Bus Transportation states that they require all superintendents to review the weekly overtime report and submit information for overtime for any employee at their division who has earned 40 or more hours of overtime in a pay period. The third recommendation.
Excuse me, Ms.
Deegan. I want to make sure I understand that. They're reporting any employee who has earned more than 40 hours of overtime?
That's what they stated, yes.
So they've worked twice the normal shift?
Well, they can, what they're doing is in their, and I'm sure Jack can explain it better, but in their way, they are monitoring all overtime, but they're getting a special report to the superintendent of bus transportation for any that are in excess of 40 hours of overtime. I think.
Just a further comment. We get a report of the top users of overtime within the authority. On the bus side, generally there's one or two. I immediately send those to Mr. Wallace or Petrocelli, and we go back and review the records of why that person did, and if there's something that we can change to make sure that the number of hours are reduced, we take action to do that.
You know, everybody here knows my concern on the overtime as it relates to safety, and
yes.
I don't know whether we're going to have to try to get a policy to just limit the number of hours somebody can work here, but it seems to me if they're working 40 hours of overtime in a pay period, they're working way too much, and it's, you know, can jeopardize the safety of our customers and fellow employees.
Well, I was going to comment on vacancies, at least on the bus side, but I was going to let Mr. Stewart finish his report.
Okay.
But
I just couldn't let that go by.
Understand?
Well, I'm glad you paused on that, because this has been a concern of mine also, and I'm concerned about the safety issue. And 40 or more hours of overtime in one pay period. A pay period is 1 week or two?
1 week for union.
What? So this is 80 hours a week?
I think that's
not adequate to get a report on 40 hours. That suggests that anything under 40 hours, like 38 or 39, would be acceptable, and it seems to me that you'd be getting reports on anybody who worked more than 20 hours of overtime in a 1 week pay period. So I have, as Mr. Deegan, I've been really concerned about this, and there just does not seem to be the level of concern about safety with respect to overtime.
Let me just address one area then. Generally, the reason for overtime is the result of the number of vacancies that you have. And let me just, again, I'm certainly more familiar with the bus numbers than the rail numbers. But in the last 6 months, we've been as high as 160 to 100 bus operator vacancies in the department. Currently, we're down to 100. We've increased the class size from 30 to 44 per class every 3 weeks. We're down to 100 vacancies with 70 people in training and 44 coming into a new class on Monday. So we anticipate on the bus side the general overtime be reduced dramatically, that our positions will be filled. We'll have an extra board fully available to do the work. The number of hours of overtime will be reduced. This past weekend when we're running shuttles placement service on the Blue Line, that work is done at overtime, and it's not something that we've scheduled, but it is work that needs to be done. So there certainly are projects, charters, or whatever that are required to generate overtime. But we are getting very close on the bus side to having the inadequate minimal level of vacancies in the department, and we're working with Mr. Hughes and Mr. File to try to generate additional classes for rail operators and train and station managers so that we can assist rail and filling their vacancies
you take them from, where are you getting those people from? You're getting them from the bus side.
Well, that's right. That's the way it's, unfortunately, is the process at this time.
But let me say, I certainly appreciate the need to have overtime when you have an emergency
right.
situation. but our money would be much more wisely spent with a recruitment effort. There are lots of people out here who need jobs, and we've got jobs. And I know it's difficult to find a bus driver because it's hard to find qualifying people, but I just think we need to work harder. And instead of paying the overtime, maybe we ought to be paying people to go recruit and find folks that, you know, can come into the workforce. I know all board members here every day, every week, how hard it is to get a job at Metro. People want to work for Metro.
I've got applications now. Folks send me that say, I can't get hired as a bus driver at Metro. Can you help me?
Absolutely. Yes.
Every 3 weeks, we bring in 44 people to go into the training class.
But maybe we ought to bring in 100. Maybe we ought to do more. And maybe we ought to go to the local government. Yeah. I just think
it's not
a crisis, and we ought to treat it as
it is.
Such.
And again, we've reduced our vacancies on the bus side, again, which is the portal, from over 160 down to 100. There's 70 in training ready to, you know, will be coming out of training in the next few weeks. More are going in, and what we're working on and have been as recently as yesterday, trying to get the rail classes scheduled so that we can get more people into rail. And I realize this has been an ongoing, a long situation. We're making progress, but we certainly have not resolved it all. And, you know, any way that we can to increase the number of people coming in the scarce skilled areas, primarily the mechanic areas, you know, we continue to work on those issues. But
anyone else?
I hear you.
Okay, I know that recently we've been doing some active outreach and recruitment into the suburbs, and certainly this is the type of thing, if it means getting clearance to set up a display board and having a person at a regional shopping mall or something, let's do it.
Advertisements right. On the radio. I haven't heard any advertisements for bus drivers on the radio. I mean, we can do more. I mean, not to say that we're not doing a lot, but I just think we can do more. Anytime.
Well, we're filling every class, but it's not making the dent fast enough. I hear you.
We need to hear back what happens with the classes, because if we are filling the classes, we are constantly trying to get people in, yet we still are so far from our numbers. Are we getting the kind of people we need into the classes to fill the vacancies? And how far back in this process do we need to go in order to meet the goal that we have? It may be a population of people that are saying, yeah, I want to come to Metro, but then there's a population of people that don't understand transit at all, so they have no desire driving a train or a bus. So are we far enough in this process to help drive the demand that we want in order to fill these vacancies?
Well, maybe what we need to do in the operations meeting is not only talk about rail cars, but to give you an update on the hiring process and the training process and the status of progress that we're making. So we can do that.
Hearing no objection. Mr. Deegan.
No objection to that, of course, but I think we have to look at how we hire bus drivers, particularly they all start part-time. And you have all these vacancies. Why are we hiring part-time bus drivers? And they start below the livable wage. So maybe that's half the problem of getting good recruits in here. And, you know, that has to be on the table to look at, you know, maybe changing.
Well, I may need some help from Mr. Hughes, but I mean, again, part-time operators, we've tried to minimize the number of part-time operators.
But what I'm saying, Jack, when they come, they have to apply as a part-time.
No, that's right. And I'm
which is starts at what, $9.90 an hour or something.
I think it's $11 an hour for the 7 weeks of training. But there is an issue if we make part-timers full-time that increases the cost of the operation. I'm not sure. I think that we've done a study of how much that might be and the benefits that it would pay. And there's no question that there's benefits, but the offset is $2 million a year. There's no question that we believe that you would get a higher quality person
that might
that has
be worth
more
the
commitment.
$2 million a year.
Yeah.
Right. It might.
So we certainly can put that on.
Yeah.
We can address that. I mean, we are very close to the point where, I mean, it does not take long for an operator to come in as part-time to go full-time. So we're not, you know, we're almost at the point where we could advertise for full-time people.
I know,
people.
When people are looking for jobs and they have families, they're looking for full-time jobs.
Yeah, there's no question about it.
And they have a full-time job that they would be leaving.
Yeah, exactly.
To come to work for Metro, they can't afford to come
work for another bus company. Right? Fairfax connector.
There you go.
I mean, we can readdress this in the budget, the FY08 budget process as one of the items I think on our in our December listing. We listed some things that were not included in the budget. For instance, security at bus facilities, parking garage maintenance. We certainly can add this to the list to make sure it's a topic of discussion in the 08 budget process.
Any other comment? I just add, Mr. Rickler, as you look at this, if there's something else to round out a person's hours as they're beginning their employment, are there some other activities that these part-time, the starting operator could be engaged in that has some value added there at the bus garage? Is something that basically rounds out their day so they do fit that full-time? Is there some other work they could be doing that would enable us to make this a viable full-time position from the start? I imagine you've given some thought to that, but if you could add that to what you're sharing with us at the
next
meeting. Okay, I think, Mr. Stewart, that completes your report on the reports. Does it?
We can stop now, yes.
Yes, okay. Next, we have the one action item before us, which is the review and acceptance of the external audit. I guess we have someone here also from KPMG.
Before we go to that, Mr. Chairman, may
yes,
I,
Mrs. Mack.
I'd just like to say I really appreciate the amount of time that
yes.
we have spent this morning going over Mrs. Stewart's report. We have in the past sort of, received them quickly, rushed right through them, and not taken the time. And I think it's been very helpful today and informative to get more understanding of what you've been doing and sort of what some of the follow-up that needs to take place, get some reassurance that that's going to happen. So this is a process that we certainly should continue
And I would also acknowledge along the same lines, Mrs. Mack, that as we do proceed toward bringing on board an auditor general, the reason we're having this discussion today is because of the work of our auditor. That Mr. Stewart has highlighted these concerns, is forcing us to stop and think, change some things, helping us to be better stewards in our job as members of the Metro Board. So I join Mrs. Mack in thanking you for this. Okay. Back to you, sir.
Okay. Well, I guess the next item really is approval of the minutes, if you would, please.
So hearing a little voice, the chair would entertain.
So moved. Second.
Okay. Motion and second. Any discussion? All those favors, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? There no objection. That is approved.
Okay. Next, Dan Kovlak, partner from KPMG, and Rachel Locus, partner from FS Taylor, are here. And Mr. Kovlak is going to present the results of the FY06 financial statement audits and the related reports.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning.
Morning.
We have a booklet for you that summarizes the results of our audit, and you should have received the detailed documents also. If you have any questions on the presentation or the detailed documents, please feel free to ask. We'll start with page one, and this is our audit team. As Jim indicated, I'm Dan Kovlak with KPMG. This is Rachel Locus with FS Taylor. And we have Irfan Satriati here, who is our audit manager for the engagement. What I intend to do this morning is cover a couple of things. One, our audit approach, which isn't very different from prior years. The audit results, which I think you'll be mostly interested in. The single audit results, which are the federal program audits. And then the required communications that we're required to tell you about under the American Institute of CPAs standards. Turn to page two. You'll see that we have an integrated audit. We have two audit firms that work together to get the audit done. We're multidisciplinary in that not only do we use auditors, but we use IT specialists, we use actuaries, and we also use tax specialists. We focus the audit on the risk areas. You can't audit every single area down to the penny, so we focus on bigger areas, the more risky areas, and we have frequent communication throughout the entire audit amongst our own team members and with Jim and his team, and also with management. On page three, we'll talk about the audit results, and they're good results again this year. You have an unqualified opinion, which is a good opinion. That means the financial statements are fairly stated. For the single audit report, you also had unqualified opinions on the compliance with laws and regulations and on internal controls over the federal programs. We issue a couple of agreed-upon procedures letters. One is the National Transportation Database for the Department of Transportation. No findings there, and we also issue a capital program funding schedule where we had one minor finding, and minor is in relation to the entire balance. We had a $70 million finding, but it is not a $14 billion balance, so it's very, very small. One of the things I do want to spend a couple of minutes on are our management letter comments. These are our comments for recommendation, and we've got six areas that we have comments in, but we had a total of 10 comments. And that's because in the last comment we summarized as the IT controls, there's actually five comments that relate to that. Under the first comment, controls over check payments, we did find while we were doing our test work we looked at 10 checks that were over $2 million and four of them hadn't been signed. They got processed by the bank. Everything seemed to be appropriate. All the documents were there and so forth, but they were cashed without being signed. So obviously that's something that needs to be addressed.
Can we stop there?
I'd love to have gotten one of those checks.
Is it automatic signatures, or someone it requires multiple signatures on a check over a certain dollar value, dollar amount? And how did that happen? I mean, I send checks out to pay bills sometimes I have to get to sign them, but they're for $100. But $2 million or what? I mean, can you elaborate a little bit more?
I don't know if anybody from management wants to address that.
Good morning. The ones over $2 million, it's supposed to be manually pulled out. And sometimes when they're doing the automated process, it just didn't get pulled out for manual signature. So one of the things we're going to try to address this year is not have the policy on the manual signature, but on the warrant that approves the automatic process.
So some financial institution processed an unsigned, 10 unsigned checks.
But they call.
Okay.
They call.
May I ask a question? Did they go to the proper vendors?
Yes. There was nothing wrong with the checks themselves, as Dan stated. It just didn't have the manual signature on it.
Okay, the second item relates to inventory cycle counts. And with the warehouse, there's a new system there. Rather than have an annual inventory, a lot of entities go to what they call cycle counts, where you do some counts every day to make sure that the records are on time accurate. And here there haven't been any cycle counts since the implementation of the new system. They're still implementing the system. So that's something that we said that this should be done pretty quickly so you can make sure you have control over the new system. The next one relates to automated payment systems. And, this is not something that's really new, but there are a lot of automated payments that are happening, and there's going to be more and more of those. And WMATA doesn't have a written policy regarding the controls over automated payments. We think that should be documented, and those policies should be followed. Well, one of the pension plans, the actuaries were still using a group annual mortality table, that's an actuarial term, from 1983. Evidently, they update these every number of years, and this one happens to be about two generations old. In other words, two. We don't think there's any major issues with that, but there are more up-to-date mortality tables that could be used, and that's our recommendation.
Mrs. Hutchins.
Is there a policy that by which you determine when you go back to do these tables, or is it driven by the industry?
It's pretty much driven by the industry, and this is, I mentioned when I started that we have a multidisciplinary team, and our actuary actually reviews all of the pension reports and all the benefit reports that WMATA has, and during that review, there are a lot of assumptions that are built into each one of these funds, and in the reports, they do indicate what tables they're using, and in this case, our actuary said, hey, this thing's pretty much out of date. Why aren't they using something more modern? And I think that that's going to be addressed with the actuary. Okay. Yeah, I would say it is a standard that could be upgraded. The next comment relates to the documentation of review over year-end journal entries. And here, a journal entry is a manual accounting entry. And the test work that we did, we felt that they were all appropriate and so forth. And in fact, Kathy is reviewing these entries, but she isn't documenting that review. So what we're saying is, hey, let's take credit for that review process. It's a good internal control, and let's just make sure we initial it and document it. And then the last one relates to the information technology. And here, as I said, we have five different comments. A lot of them relate to the fact that you do have new systems that are getting implemented, and while you do that, not all the controls are functioning during the implementation process, and that's what a lot of these relate to, and I think a lot of these will be resolved over the next year or so. The first one has to do with the documentation of segregation of duties, like it should be better documented as to who can do what, and that the people shouldn't be standing in for somebody else. There should be an adequate segregation of duties. That's a basic control. There should be better documentation regarding program changes, when there are changes made to programs. A better policy with regard to that. Access controls are always a concern, passwords, people getting into rooms and so forth. That can be improved. Service continuity, what happens if there's some sort of a disaster or an incident where...
This says a repeat comment, meaning that this has been a letter. Is that what that means?
Which one is that?
On the access control.
Yeah, well, what happens is each year, because we do the audit on a test basis, we look at different phases. We can't do the whole thing all at once. We look at different phases. So this is one of the comments where it actually was resolved, and we had a repeat comment. And that is because we have access control problems in a different area. So when we get down to the next point where we had six comments last year, three were resolved. One of them is actually access controls were resolved, but they're again repeated. And then we have service continuity. As I said, if you have an incident or a disaster or whatever, the process could be better. And then security programs with regard to the passwords again.
Let me ask Mr. Stewart the more detailed breakout of the management letter recommendations are provided to us in Appendix A. And just as we have a policy with setting timeline for implementation, for ensuring that audit recommendations are followed up upon, here we have a management letter with specific recommendations. I think my colleagues would support us putting in a timeline so we ensure that the recommendations for our auditors are also put in place, so we get that resolved before the next audit.
I will do that and make sure it happens.
Okay. Any objection to that?
No.
Okay.
One thing you should be aware of, though, and I think that's an excellent policy, in many cases where we do have a recommendation, particularly when it comes to IT, a lot of these things cannot be solved really, really quickly because, as you know, it takes a year, or, as he said this morning, 20 months to get a program implemented. So sometimes they won't be completely resolved within the next year. But one of the things that we do, or we're actually required to do as auditors, is to follow up on the prior year comments and see that they are being addressed. And if not, we're to report them again. For the six prior year comments, we had three that were resolved. They related to The documentation of revenue recognition, revenue reconciliations, they related to accounts payable, and they related to segregation of duties. All of these have been resolved. As I mentioned, segregation of duties was repeated. That was resolved. Under the repeated ones, the access controls were repeated, the service continuity was repeated, and the security programs were repeated. And those fall into that category that I described where sometimes you can't fix all this all in one year. One of the other things we're required to do is report to the board on our past audit differences. And that means there are audit dollar adjustments that we find that are just too small to record in the financial statements. Now, we recommend to management to record the bigger audit adjustments, but in some cases management says, hey, these are too small, and we as auditors say we agree they are too small, and we have a list of them here. There's only six of them, which is pretty good for an organization of this size. And when you look at these numbers, the biggest number is the item number two, which is for $6 million. And if you take that $6 million and you compare it to the total assets that you have way at the bottom of $10 billion, you can see that $6 million is really, really insignificant.
$6 million.
The other thing too is you have to look at the characteristic of the adjustment. One of the things we do is say, okay, why did this occur? Is there an internal control problem here? And is it indicative that there might be others like that? Because we do the audit on a test basis. And that one, for example, was revenue that should have been recognized in the prior year. It was a refund, and it was decided that it would be used in the current year. From an accounting standpoint, it should be recognized as revenue. In the prior year, it wasn't. It was recognized this year, so we took it out of revenues for an accounting purposes out of this year. So, again, it was kind of an isolated instance, wasn't really that big in the whole scheme of things when you look at the financial statements overall. Unless there are any other questions on any of those, I'd be glad to go through each one, but again, since they're not material, I'm not sure how interested you are.
Any questions? Please proceed.
Okay. On page 5, we talk about the single audit, and this is the federal audit. We do an audit for federal purposes, and the idea behind a single audit was before, years and years ago, there used to be a requirement to have almost every program audited, and you'd have auditors come in here and auditing all the different programs. So now there's one single audit to audit the federal programs. As I mentioned before, the internal control report was unqualified, and the compliance report with laws and regulations regarding these programs was unqualified. There's one comment, which is a carryover comment, and this again falls into the category of the kind of comment that can't be fixed in one year. And it relates to the security at the bus locations. And you say, well, what does the federal government care about our security? Well, since they pretty much fund a good portion of the buses, they want to make sure that there's adequate security over them. I think we visited something like 8 locations, and we had some concerns with regard to security for 4 of them. And management is certainly aware of this and working with it. I think they've discussed that with the board before. It was a comment from last year. The major programs that we look at, and when I say major programs, these are the high-dollar programs, and there's a definition on how we calculate these for audit purposes. The 3 are listed here. If you add up those 3 programs, they had total expenses of about $239 million out of a total expense of $241. So you can see with those 3 programs, we cover just about everything. Because of the one finding of the security at the bus locations, WMATA is not considered a low-risk auditee. The only thing that means is that low-risk auditee is that the auditors would have to do less audit work. So because you are a higher risk, we're required to do more sampling. Now, once you get that resolved, and I'm sure you will, you have to go 2 years before you can become a low-risk auditee. So assuming there's no more findings, assuming that's resolved, next year, if I say, hey, that's resolved, I'll say you still can't be a low-risk auditee because the rules are you have to have no findings for 2 years.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Sullivan.
So how do you, what's your recommendation on how to resolve the security improvement at the bus facility?
Well, a lot of these, they have things in the works. I think that's more of a question for management. But obviously, when we go there, we want to say, okay, is it fenced in? Sometimes they're not. You might have police protection. Sometimes you might have a guard station before people can get in. There's a whole variety of things, and I think management's best to address that. One of the concerns that we had is that, we were able to go into the facility and pretty much have access to almost anything. So we just want to make sure that not anybody can do that. You know, not just anybody can walk up and do that. But again, I think that's a management decision.
Ms. Mack.
I remember this issue coming up, and is it in our current 08 budget?
No. In 07, we brought forth two initiatives. One was to add special police at bus facilities, and the second was to add police on the street for bus dedicated to bus activities. And we funded the on street on bus program, but not the facility program. The staff in 08, it is listed as one of the unfunded items, and it's not included in the 08 proposal. What staff has done, and as a result of these reviews over the last two or three years, you know, we've improved lighting where we can. We've cut back the shrubbery and things to try to provide as much visibility. Attempted to train our employees on, quizzing anyone that's coming through a facility. But some of our facilities have 4, 5, 6 different entrances. People, you know, are able to wander in. We've fortunately not had any major theft or vandalism as a result of people coming on the property. But, you know, at Southeast, I mean, the gates are wide open. It's a 24-hour facility. Unfortunately, the one facility that we are, we fix all the fences, the lights, and whatever. One of the deficiencies was at Bladensburg, which is totally fenced, has only one entrance, has a security guard 24/7, but somebody was able to get through that and onto the property, and that's why we quizzed them on Bladensburg, because that is the one with the best security that we have. So, again, we've attempted to do the low-cost items. We believe that adding security 24/7 at the open facilities is the best answer, and it's currently not funded or proposed.
Well, I think we ought to take a hard look at the budget proposal and assure that the budget that we approved for 2008 does indeed include sufficient funds. I think this, just to take one more shot at the cell phones, that $500,000, you know, probably would have gone a long way to help in this process. A little bit of that overtime, Charlie, so we could have gotten this done. But I do think
we'll make sure it's an item of discussion in the process to make sure that it gets addressed.
And lastly, the last bullet on page 5 does indicate that management agrees with that comment. Now, on page 6, we begin the required communications of the American Institute of CPAs. And the first one deals with the conduct of the audit. And it's our responsibilities as auditors to do the audit. It's management's responsibilities to prepare the financial statements. And that's how it did work here. As far as significant accounting policies go, we do look at the accounting policies and make sure that they are reasonable and they make sense for the organization, are appropriate. And there were no significant changes to those policies this year. If there were, we'd bring them to your attention. Like any organization, financial statements are not perfect, and there are judgments and estimates that are involved in developing the financial statements. And three of the bigger judgments and estimate areas there are deferred revenues, pension benefit assumptions, as I mentioned earlier, and liabilities for injury and damage claims. In each of these areas, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, so what you have to do is develop a methodology in order to determine what your best estimate is, and then if you have information, actual information that comes in later on, you can change your methodology to make sure that those estimates are even more accurate than they were in the past. Now, what we did is we looked at Romano's methodology for these, and we looked at the judgments and estimates and the balances, and we did conclude that there's a reasonable basis for these judgments and estimates. On page 7, significant audit adjustments, management does consult with us on significant accounting and reporting matters, and the unrecorded audit adjustments we covered a couple of pages ago. We had no disagreements with management over the application of accounting principles, and we're not aware that WMATA management has consulted with any other accountants regarding accounting principles. We also discuss a number of accounting principles prior to our retention, but none of these were a condition of our retention. In other words, WMATA didn't hire us as a result of opinion shopping. In other words, if you like this accounting treatment, we'll hire you. There was none of that prior to our being hired. And we did not encounter any difficulties in performing the audit. On page 8, we're required to tell you about significant communications, and the first one is our engagement letter. This is sent by us to management at the beginning of the audit, setting forth the timing of the audit and all the characteristics of how the audit will be conducted. The management rep letter is actually a document that management gives us to indicate to us that they shared with us all the information we need to do the audit, and to the best of their knowledge and belief, the financial statements are fairly stated. And then lastly, the management letter is what we discussed earlier, which is our comments of recommendations to management. So these are the key communications that we've had. And lastly, we do confirm to you that we are independent, and therefore we are able to perform the audit.
You're not Jim's brother-in-law?
No. I said no. I'm not even his brother. On the last page, I was going to open it up for any questions, but one thing that I do want to bring to your attention is that the American Institute of CPAs has changed its definitions for internal control deficiencies. And what that means is that the findings that we have in the management letter, if they were more significant, they might appear in your internal control report, the auditor's report on internal control. Remember earlier I said that that was an unqualified opinion. If we had significant findings, those findings could either be material weaknesses or this year they'd be called reportable conditions. Those definitions are changing for next year. The American Institute has changed the definition of a material weakness. They've changed the definition of a reportable condition. And in fact, they've even changed the name of a reportable condition to be called a significant deficiency. So you won't see the term reportable condition anymore. You'll see the term significant deficiency. They've changed the definition so that it makes it more likely that more comments will fall within the significant deficiencies category and more comments will fall within the material weakness category and less in the bottom category, the lowest category of management letters. Now, I have the definitions over on page 11 and 12, and I won't go through them with you as I just summarized them, but I think we've got a nice picture on page 13 of where the American Institute of CPAs is going with this. And the reason why they did this is because the Public Accounting Oversight Board did that for public companies. And their rulings do not affect non-public companies, so the American Institute of CPAs wanted to make their standards consistent with the PCAOB standards, and therefore that's why we have this new standard. It's effective for years ending after December 15th, 06, which falls for you in June 30th, 07. It's not effective for the past audit, but but it will be effective for the future audit. Reason why I'm bringing this to your attention is that we haven't had any comments in the category of reportable conditions. However, in the future, we might have some that fall into significant deficiencies as a result of just the change in the definition of what the comments are. Now, obviously, there is some judgment involved in determining what category these fall in, and you know, when we ultimately look at these comments, we will have discussions with our team members and with management and with Jim's group in order to decide what category that they fall in. So it won't be a decision that will be made in vacuum, but I do want to bring that to your attention that there may be a change in the future, not as a result of our judgment, but as a result of the standards that we have to follow. With that, I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Any questions? I think we haven't been shy as you made your presentation. Hearing none, the chair would entertain a motion for approval to move this audit forward to the full board.
So moved.
Second. Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The chair votes aye. Mr. Stewart, anything else to come before us?
No, there's not.
Hearing saying nothing, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Stay here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.